Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick, your host for this presentation in the Inland Mariners audio series. In this interview, I'm talking with Charlie Shoup, former Great Lakes ship captain and current Great Lakes pilot, recorded in February 2021. So I think where I'd like to start is kind of your family history. Kind of tell me a little bit about where you grew up and your background and how you got into the sailing, and maybe a little bit about your family.
Sure. So I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, kind of about as far away from the water as you can get in Michigan. But my dad had worked on the boats, you know, when he was growing up. He's from Detour. So he went into the Navy in 1962. He did 4 years in the Navy. And then after he got out of the Navy, he worked 3 years on the lakes, 67, 68, and 69. But he quit sailing before I was ever born. But growing up, I always heard stories about when he worked on the boats and that sort of thing. And my grandmother's house is in Detour. It's right by Watson's Reef Light. And so growing up, I saw the boats go by. And, you know, I always knew about the boats, you know.
Sure.
I never really thought much about working on them. I always thought it was kind of cool, but, but other than that, I never thought too much about it. I was an auto mechanic. I went to high school half a day, and then I went to trade school the other half of the day and got a license as an auto mechanic when I was 17. And I don't know, my dad said one day, he says, "Hey, why don't you go out on the boat and you can make some money this summer and buy that big toolbox that you want?" And I said, "Well, that sounds like a pretty good idea." Well, unbeknownst to me, my dad's first cousin was Byron Kelly. I don't know if you know that name.
No, I don't.
Byron Kelly was the vice president of the SIU Great Lakes. So he ran the Great Lakes as far as the SIU was concerned. So the Seafarers International Union. So, you know, they're first cousins. So he called them up and said, "Hey, is there any way we can get Charlie a job out on the boats this summer?" And Byron says, "Well, yeah, no problem, you know." So back then, you had to have what was called a letter of intent to employ. You couldn't just go and get a Z-card if you wanted one. You had to have somebody in the industry that was willing to, you know, put their name on a piece of paper and say, "Yep, you know, we want this guy."
Sure.
So Byron Kelly made some phone calls, and I got a letter of intent to employ from Boblo, which, you know, I'm sure you know, they ran passenger ferries down to Boblo Island in Detroit.
Yes.
A theme park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I got a letter of intent to employ from them, but I never actually went to work for them. I was hanging around the union hall and messing around and doing what 19-year-old kids do, and I got a phone call, and Byron called me into his office, and he says, "Hey, would you consider working on a tugboat?" I said, "Well, yeah, I don't care. I'm just looking to work. I don't give a shit." And he says, "Well, good." And so I went to work for Hannah Marine on the Mary E. Hannah, July 19th of 1990. So I caught the Mary E. Hannah in Detroit at the mail boat. And at that time, she was doing kind of a weird thing. For a few years there, she pushed a barge called the Marmac 5, and it was a 250-foot by 72-foot flat deck barge with a pig pen, like a retaining wall around it, and they loaded stone and brought it down to the river dock. It was under a charter by Jimmy Palladino, who owned the river dock, and he also owned the stone quarry on Kelly's Island. And so he was in the process of rebuilding this stone quarry on Kelly's Island. He had bought it, but it hadn't been used since before World War II. And he had a contract. They were redoing some of the freeways in Cleveland, and he had a contract to supply the stone. And so he had a yard there in Cleveland, the river dock on West 3rd Street. And he bought the stone quarry and was getting it going again. So, but until then, we ran from Stoneport down to Cleveland, and then once he opened the quarry, it was Easter Sunday of 1991. And so then we started running from Kelly's Island to Cleveland. Jimmy Palladino didn't like the fact that tugboats and barges got delays that ships didn't have, and he didn't really, I don't think, understand that, you know, it's a different animal. So he went and he bought a barge and was having it converted to be a self-unloader, because the loading and unloading process on the flat deck barge was terrible. And then we were supposed to push it, but then he went and bought a tugboat, and he had a nephew or something that went to a maritime academy and got a pretty basic license. And he took a lot of the guys that he knew and just kind of put them all these guys on a boat. Like, he took the guy that was his mechanic in the yard and fixed all of his front end loaders and stuff and made him the engineer, and, you know, took some guys that drove payloaders and made them deckhands, and they went out and were going to go out and operate this thing more efficiently than we were. And in the early 90s, they ran over a sailboat and killed a bunch of people, and it was bad. So that didn't work out so well. But the tugboat that he bought was called the Palladino, and I think the barge was something, Kelly's Island or something. But
I think I've heard the Palladino name. That's familiar somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the Frank Palladino.
Yeah. Well, let me back you up, Charlie, to when you caught the... So, where was the Union Hall? Was that in Detroit?
It's in Algonac, then. It had already moved from Detroit up to Algonac.
Okay. What was that place like? Was it a small, single building, or what do you recall of that?
It's still the same building to this day. So, they moved the Union Hall from Detroit up to Algonac to kind of keep the riffraff out, you know, supposedly, you know. Because obviously, if you had to drive, you know, Algonac's a small town out in the middle of nowhere, so you had to have a car to be able to drive out there and have the means to get there and whatnot. So it's a nice building. It's brick. It's two stories in parts. It's got a big boat well. It's right on the St. Clair River. Just when you make the turn from the St. Clair River over, as the river starts to delta into Lake St. Clair, there's the South Channel, the North Channel, and the Middle Channel. And just where it wise and forks right there, it's just as you start to go down the North Channel, so it's right on the edge. Hmm. At one time, they had a big Chris Craft, and you could get a job in the Union Hall, and the little Chris Craft would run you right out to the boat right there, and you'd change out right in front of the Union Hall. That's gone by the wayside. They don't do that anymore.
Hmm. When you caught the Mary Hannah, you went out on the... Uh-huh. The Westcott. Can you recall that experience when you first caught the barge, and what your thoughts were of getting onto a tug? And
yeah, so my dad worked for the Steel Trust, or for Great Lakes, or U.S. Steel, you know, mm-hmm. Great Lakes, what's now Great Lakes Fleet. And back then, like, you didn't talk to the captain and unless he talked to you. And the captain walked down one side of the boat, and everybody else walked down the other side of the boat. Because, of course, they were forward enders, and you had to walk back aft to go to dinner. It was very regimented, and those are the stories that I heard, and that's what I had in my mind going aboard.
Sure.
And, you know, the other thing was is that, you know, my dad's like, well, you know, I mean, you get into a disagreement with a guy on a boat, and you go down to the dock, and you settle it, and... You know, of course, that's fighting, you know. So I get on there, and all of these guys look like apes. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'7", and right now I'm about 260 pounds. But back then I was 6'7", and about 180 pounds. And I thought, oh, this is not going to be good. The first guy I met, his name was Toledo Joe Ravery. He was a chief engineer for Hannah, and quite a character and quite well known in the tugboat circles. But he's a really nice guy, and he lived in Hillsdale, Michigan, of all weird places. But yeah, good guy. I worked on the Hannah for, you know, I don't know, but I worked there 90, 91, 92. And then in 92 was when Paladino got his tugboat, so they defaulted on the contract. So then the Hannah didn't have any plans for the Mary because they expected that it would be working for Paladino. Mm-hmm. And it kind of got dropped on their lap last second. So then I was kind of unemployed for half the year, and I went and turned wrenches at a Ford dealer, and it was terrible, and I went back sailing as fast as I could.
So what was a typical day like? What do you remember your first day on the Mary?
So my first day was pretty laid back. They were good. They said, you know, hey, just kind of, you know, put your stuff away, get settled in. Because it was a day, the first day was underway at sea, and it was, but I remember going up to the pilot house, going across Lake Erie in the middle of the night, and I could see the lights of Cleveland, you know, and I was talking to the mate, pretty sure it was Claude Sankey from Milwaukee, and I was like, oh, geez, you know, that was fast, we're almost there. He goes, what? No, he says, we got another 3 hours yet. And I'm looking right at the lights of the city, and I'm thinking, how in the world could that be 3 hours away? But when you're making 8 miles an hour, it takes a while.
Yeah, it does. So they were already loaded, and you picked them up in the river?
Yep. She had 5,000 tons of stone on her, and she was down by the head. It was a bad load. Down by the head means that the draft on the forward end of the barge is, or ship, is more than the after end of the barge or ship. So when a ship is loaded down by the head, it becomes unstable and it doesn't want to go straight. It will turn relatively easily, but it won't track straight for you going down the river. So it's a bad condition for a ship to leave port down by the head.
Was that a normal occurrence, or did they just load it improperly?
Loaded improperly. Yeah, it's not a normal occurrence for them. It just happened to be that way, that, you know, they were still working out the bugs and trying to figure out how to load this barge. It was, that contract had just started a month before, you know, it was maybe their third or fourth time loading that barge.
Okay. You were a deckhand at this point?
That's correct. Yep.
You probably had to join the union to get on the ship, is that correct? So, you're going to Cleveland. What do you recall? Any experiences on that, going up the river, or?
So my first trip into Cleveland, there was a dead body under the Detroit Superior Viaduct. I had never seen a dead body before.
In the river?
Yeah, it was floating in the river. Looked like he had been there for a few days, and he wasn't fresh by any means.
Oh.
For a 19-year-old kid, that was pretty remarkable, you know.
Yeah. Cleveland was a lot different back in those days than it is today, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Have you been to Cleveland much? Have you ever been down that way?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
So this was right before the flats started swinging. At this point, when you pulled into the river, there were a couple of places. Shooters was there, and there were a couple of bars that they were just converting what's called the powerhouse, which is right next to the Nautica stage now. But they were just converting the powerhouse from an actual electrical generation station to a complex full of bars and restaurants. But most of the flats was still warehouses. Samsel's still there, but Samsel was there. You know, all of the CD joints were there, but most of it was just warehouses and, you know, loading docks and things.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next several years, you know, it exploded, and all of the warehouses were either torn down or turned into bars or music venues or both or restaurants. And the flats really became quite a swinging place for probably almost 10 years. And then they started getting into trouble down there, and now it's all moved up the hill and into what's called the warehouse district.
Right, yeah, there's not much left. I know Shooters is still there.
Yep, but, you know, working on the tugs, and then when I went to work for American in 93 on the steamer John J. Boland, we would load salt out of Cleveland over in the old riverbed. And then in 94, I was on the Buffalo, and we ran up and down the Cuyahoga all the time. So I got to see Cleveland, or the flats, you know, kind of bloom and then die off. I was there for all of it.
So where would you unload the stone, and how would they unload the stone on the, off the Mary Hanna?
We were at what's called the river dock, and if you were looking at a chart, there's a little V between the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge, and which is Lorraine Avenue, and then it would be, there's a an old railroad bridge. I'm trying to remember the which line it is, but it's West 3rd Street. It's almost right across the street from the Yellow Cab headquarters there on West 3rd. So they were unloading it by clamshell. They had one Manitowoc crane that would come down, and it would scoop, take a scoop and swing over and dump it on the dock, and then payloaders would take it away. And then when they got it down to a certain level, they would pick up one of the payloaders and put it on the barge, and it would, you know, scoop up the corners and sides and bring them to the center and make a pile, and then the clamshell would come down and take that pile until they got it all. And then they'd pick up the payloader and put it back on the dock, and we'd leave. Back then, it would take about 36 hours to unload the barge.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how long. I would think that would be a long process.
Yeah, it got better. After a while, we could do it in 18 to 24 hours, you know, but those first couple times, they had to kind of figure out how to pick up the payloader and, you know, what they were going to do and how they were going to do it.
How large was the crew on the tug that you were on?
We had 7 guys. We had a captain and a mate, a cook, a chief, and 2 deckhands, captain, mate, cook, chief, 2 deckhands, 6.
So you were working a lot of hours then.
It was 6 on and 6 off plus overtime.
And I suspect when you're unloading, it's a lot of overtime?
Actually, no. The dock guys took care of all the cargo work. We just had to have one guy that was around to 10 lines. As the barge gets empty, of course, it rises up higher in the water, so you have to walk around the barge and, you know, let out a little bit of line so that you don't break them.
Did you have winches on deck to do that?
No, it was all like 3-inch nylon line around like a 24-inch cleat.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe a 30-inch cleat. They're pretty good size cleats.
What kind of skills did you learn as a mariner working on that for 2.5 years?
You learn a lot of soft line stuff because, you know, you're doing nylon line. So tying knots and splicing and chipping and painting. And since you don't have a lot of guys on the boats, everybody's kind of pitches in and does everything. So I rebuilt engines, changed out water pumps, worked in the engine room quite a bit. Because I came from an automotive background, I already had a mechanical aptitude, so I was doing really well. Matter of fact, right before they laid up the Mary E., the chief engineer was talking to the office about when he went on vacation that they ought to give me a shot as a chief engineer on the tug. Chief engineer on a ship is quite a bit different than chief engineer on a tug. The tugs, they don't have the same Coast Guard requirements, so you don't have to have a license as a chief engineer to be a chief engineer on a tug. Just a deckhand's Z card is all you need. Yeah. And, of course, the nod from the company to say that, yeah, he's okay, he can run the engines. But I started them up and shut them down and transferred fuel into the day tanks, and I did a lot on the tugboats. So that's a great place to learn. It's quite dangerous. As far as a maritime job goes,
I
saw more risky, crazy shit happened in 3 years on tugs than I did in 30 years on ships. Maybe not, but pretty close.
What makes a tug so much more dangerous? The smaller size, or?
Just the way that they operate and the mindset of the guys that operate them. In order to, you know, be a captain on a big ship, you have, there's lots of training. You're part of a big corporation. You're probably taking lots of safety seminars and sitting in on classes and all of this stuff. And they have a safety program and all of those things. On a tugboat, it's a lot less of that. It's kind of more, at least back then, it was kind of, here's a boat, here's a crew, go out and do stuff. And then they did. So, like, the barge, when it's empty, sits, I'd say, you know, maybe 20 foot out of the water, you know, 15 to 20 feet out of the water. And the fantail of the tug is right down low. I mean, in a good sea, it's the fantail of a tug is awash. So you might be 2 feet or 3 feet above the water's edge.
Right.
When you're standing on the fantail.
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen is you would face up to the barge and put the bow of the tug against the barge, and you had two cables on each side that went up to the barge and attached to bits on the barge, and then those cables were attached to winches, and then you'd pull those winches tight, and that's how the barge would be attached to the tugboat, so that the tugboat, when it turned or stopped or whatever, the barge would be part of this same unit, so it would act as one unit, right?
Right.
But when you get out into Lake Erie or out, you know, out of port, if the waves are over 3 or 4 feet, the barge and the tug start bouncing around at different times, and there's nothing to lock them in like there is on an ATB or an ITB. So you have to get away from the barge. So what would happen is we'd leave Cleveland, and as a deckhand, I would climb up on the barge from the bow of the tug, and then I would go and they would slack down the winches, and I would let those cables go. And then I would stay on the barge, and the tug would go around to the other end of the barge, and I would meet them there on the bow of the barge. And there's a big towing winch on the stern of the tug, and it goes to a big symbol, and then there's two towing bridles. They're, you know, I don't know, 50 foot, you know, maybe 80 foot long cables. Maybe they're 100 feet. They're attached to the thimble at one end, and they have a big eye at the other end, and they have a heaving line attached to the eye. And so they'd throw the heaving line up to me, and I would pull these cables up onto the bow of the barge, and then I would walk them out to the corners and put them on the bits that were on the bow of the tug. And now that's done, and they're attached, but now I have to get from the barge 20 foot down onto the tug.
Mm-hmm.
So the chief engineer was usually operating the towing winch, so the captain would back the tug right up against the barge or just underneath the rake of the barge, because, of course, the bow is sloped. So they'd get right underneath the bow, and they'd take a wooden ladder and put it up against the barge, and you'd scramble down this 20-foot wooden ladder as fast as you could, because you're out in the weather, and the barge is bouncing around, and the tug is bouncing around, and the ladder's flexing and dancing all over the place. So you climb down this ladder real quick, and then when you get down on the barge, you've got to clear the fantail and get off the fantail, because if the barge or the tug moves and that cable comes tight, it'll hit you, and it'll knock you over the side. Or Hannah had one guy got hit in the head with a thimble and got killed while I was working there. In Hamilton, Ontario.
So it must take a lot of muscle to pull that cable from the heaving line up onto that barge, right? Those are pretty heavy?
Yeah, they are heavy. I was a pretty good-sized kid, you know, 180 pounds and, you know, 6'7". But when I called to talk to Hannah for the first time about getting the job, Byron Kelly gave me this number, and he says, call this guy, and he's the head of personnel for Hannah Marine, a guy named Paul Kuhlander. And that was one of the first things that Paul asked me. He says, well, how big are you, kid? Well, 6'7" and 180 pounds. He goes, that'll do. Okay. But yeah, it's a physically demanding. demanding job, absolutely. I'd work on the Mary E. during the season, but the stone docks shut down, and back then they'd shut down in November, or at least we would shut down in November and stop moving stone for Paladino. And then they'd take me over, and I'd work in the Chicago River on some of their other tugs. I worked on a lot of tugs for Hannah. The Mary E. Hannah, the Donald C. Hannah, the Betty Gale, the Catherine L., it was called the Tug Challenger, but then they renamed it the Mark Hannah, the Susan Hannah, the Margaret. I worked on the Margaret Hannah. I worked on a lot of their boats.
I was going to ask you, why didn't you stay with Hannah when Paladino took over, or did you stay with them?
So when Paladino got their own tugboat, like I say, they didn't anticipate it. It was kind of a backdoor deal. And when Paladino started running the barge with his own tug and his own crew, they laid the Mary E. up because they didn't know it was going to happen. They didn't schedule any work for it. And they were scrambling to find a contract, you know, because it's a big tug. It's 142 foot. It's got two 16-cylinder EMDs in it.
Really? Wow, I didn't realize that it had that much power.
Yeah, it does. 4,500 horse or something. It was a World War II Army tug in the South Pacific. At one time, it had a crew of 21. Yeah, it was a great big tug. A lot of power, twin screw.
Okay. So I'm curious about your experiences you went in the Chicago River or the Calumet?
Well, so the first time they sent me over there, I was on the Betty Gale, which is like an 86-foot tugboat. In comparison, it was tiny. And we did what was called the Chicago Shuffle. So big tows come up the Mississippi River, and as they go up the river, they get broken down into smaller and smaller units. And then they come up the Illinois River up to Lamont, and then there's big yards down there where they tie these barges up. And then you take this Betty Gale, and you go down there, and you grab a barge or two, and you would take them up through the sanitary ship canal and through the Thomas J. O'Brien locks into the Calumet River, and you would drop them off at, you know, various locations along the way. And then while you were up there, you'd grab some empties, and then you'd take them back down to Tri-Central or back down to Lamont, where there's a bridge in Lamont, Illinois, that the big tugs can't get under. And it was a drawbridge at one time. And if you look into history, you'll see that there were some pretty big ships and things that were moved through the river at one time. But nowadays, you can't do any of that because of this bridge in Lamont. So it doesn't open anymore, and it hasn't in, I don't know, probably since World War II. It's been a long, long time. So the big tugs can't get through it, so they have to drop these barges off before that bridge. But the Betty Gale and the Donald and the Margaret and the Catherine L. and all these tugs, they have a jack-up pilot house. It's a big hydraulic ram underneath the pilot house, and you can raise it up so you can see over your barges, but then when you get to a bridge, you can actually lower it down, duck under the bridge, and then pop back up on the other side again. That's how they run through the river.
How long of a run was that, say, from Lamont up to the Calumet?
Well, that's been a long time. I would say maybe 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, so not a significant amount of time. So you're always working then.
Oh, yeah. Well, same thing, 6 and 6, plus overtime. So took 2 deckhands to go through the locks and to tie up or to let go. So, you know, you slept when you could. You know, we'd also go to, with those tugs, because they're small little twin-knee push boats is what they are. And, we'd go to as far as Burns Harbor. We'd also go in through the Chicago River through the locks at Navy Pier. Through the loop and right through downtown, because it's a big Y shape. The Chicago River goes down, and it goes down towards Lamont, and then the Calumet River goes to Lake Calumet, but right before you get to Lake Calumet is the Thomas J. O'Brien Lock. and you go through the Thomas J. O'Brien lock, and you're in the CalSAG channel. The CalSAG and the sanitary ship canal from Chicago, which is the Chicago River, they come together, and right at the point that's created, the point of land that's right between the two, that was Hannah's yard, Route 83 and Archer Avenue. It was a crazy place. First time I drove down there, they said, well, have you ever been here before? And I said, no. And I said, okay. Well, you got to go into this junkyard, and you drive through this junkyard, and it was kind of one of those places where, like, you kind of go and get your own parts. And so you pull onto this road, and there were cars stacked up 6 cars high, you know, on both sides of the road, and there's all kinds of people running around, and all this shit going on, and there's people down there with cutting torches and all kinds of shit. And I pull into this junkyard, and I'm looking around going, what the fuck? And then I drive to this thing, and I'm driving to the back of this yard, and across the back of this yard is a railroad grade, you know, kind of elevated about, you know, 20 or 30 feet higher than the junkyard was. And underneath this railroad grade, there was a tunnel. And you have to go back through this yard, and you go through this tunnel, and there's, like, water across the road, like, you know, like a foot deep. And you drive down through the water, through this tunnel, you pop up on the other side, and it's just kind of a bunch of scrubby-ass trees and, you know, shit laying everywhere. And then you get back in there, and you turn around the corner, and there's Hannah's office. I'm like, what the hell kind of outfit am I working for?
Not your corporate headquarters you were expecting.
Not at all. But as far as running tugboats, it was an ideal location. It just takes a lot to get back in there. But if you're ever looking at a map, it's Route 83 and Archer Avenue are the closest crossroads, and you can see the junkyard, and you can go back through there, and you can look at it on a satellite map, maybe.
You probably can't get back there now with Homeland Security, I'm sure.
That's a good question. I don't know. It's still an operating boatyard of some description. There's still tugs and barges tied up there from the satellite view last time I looked. Matter of fact, an interesting little side note, Hannah Marine, Hannah Tug Company, because there's Hannah Mining and Hannah Marine, and they're two different companies. So Hannah Marine's out of Lamont, Illinois, Chicago area. Hannah Mining, I don't know where they are. I never worked for them. But at one time, they owned the George Stinson.
Right.
But anyway, Hannah Marine was a tugboat company, and the actress, Daryl Hannah, that's her family. Her father and her uncle owned Hannah Marine.
No kidding.
Yep.
And she's married now to Neil Young.
Oh, I didn't know that.
How was Hannah to work for? Were they a good outfit? Were they...
In 1990, okay, so when I got hired on in 1990... As a 19-year-old kid, I made $142 a day plus overtime.
Okay.
Full union benefits. So within a few months of me starting, we went up to $144 a day. So I was making $12 an hour in 1990, you know, with no real background, no skilled trade or anything yet. You know, I was just a deckhand learning as I went. So that was pretty good money. Then.
Yeah. How would they determine overtime? What is it, like a time and a half for so many hours from, like, maybe, was it a 10-hour day you work, or you work, how do they consider it? Is it a 12-hour day with yours?
Yeah, 12-hour day. You're 6 and 6. That was your day. So I worked from midnight till 6 in the morning and noon until 6 in the afternoon. And then anything beyond that was time and a half.
Okay. Time and a half, okay. And holidays were probably...
Double time.
It sounds like you had a pretty good deal. What made you abandon that and go to American Steamship?
When Palladino took over and ran his own barge, they laid the Mary E. up, and they didn't have a job for me. They laid me off. So I was collecting unemployment, and I went down to the union hall and paid my union dues and whatever. And they said, well, you want a job? I said, yeah. I mean, preface that. They laid me off, and I was collecting unemployment. My son was born, and I was kind of thinking maybe it would be a better deal to be home more often. And then I got that job as an auto mechanic, and I hated it. So then I went back sailing, and I was in paying my union dues, and they said, "Do you want a job on the John J. Boland?" This is the old steamer John J. Boland with the telescoping hatches and the tarps and the battens and the cable-operated boom. So he had boom cables, and it was a workhorse. You know, nobody wanted that job. So in October of 93, I got on, October 25th of 93, I got on a John J. Boland, and I sailed into the layup that year.
Can I back you up to the tugs a little bit? So when you worked on all the smaller ones on the Illinois and the Calumet, was that in between trips with the Mary E., or was that?
Usually off-season.
Okay. Off-season would be what for that ship? December to?
December to, you know, March or April.
Okay. Okay. So you worked year-round. You didn't have, like, the winter layup like the Lakers do.
Time for time, so you'd, you know, 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, so it wasn't that bad to work year-round, because, you know, you still only worked half the year.
Was that a regular thing that you would go 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off? Is that a mandatory requirement?
Well, when you're working six and six, after 3 weeks, you're pretty burnt out.
I would think so.
So, I mean, certainly there were times where I worked more than that, but that was the intention. Whether or not they could find a relief and get them out to you in time was another story. But
tell me a little bit about the catching the John J. Boland and how all that went down, where you caught it. And
I caught it at the mailboat again. However, this time we were upbound, and I don't remember where we went first. Stone Dock, I would think, Stoneport or Calcite or one of those places. The Boland, it got around quite a bit more. We did get around quite a bit on the tugs, to some interesting places. And I had two trips on tugs up to Marquette before I got on the Boland. But the Boland, I had never been to Duluth before. So my first time in Duluth was in the fall of 93. It was probably November. And we had an interesting run then. We had seven trips back-to-back from Midwest Energy to Thunder Bay, Ontario. And the paper mill that's all the way up the river there,
up the Kaministiquia there?
Yeah, the Kaministiquia, yep. You go into the Mission River entrance and then up to the Cam and go up that way. All the way up, there's a paper mill right before you get to the highway. You can't even get up there anymore. They built the roadway across it, so no ships can get up there at all anymore. But back then you could. And we had a relief captain on board. When I first got on board, it was James Van Doggen, who later on in my career became very influential and a very good friend of mine. But this guy was Captain Ed Derry, and he struggled to get up the river. There were a lot of Patterson boats laid up and tied up along the banks of the river going up.
They had that office right by that swing bridge there.
I don't know where their office was. I just remember there being a lot of Patterson boats tied up in the river, and they were just, like, in long-term storage, you know. They weren't active. There were a bunch of them up there, and they were on both sides of the river, and it narrowed it down quite a bit, and we kind of banged our way up up through them to get up there to the paper mill. And when you got to the paper mill, you had to really pour it to it and ram the bow up into the mud. And they liked the Boland because it had a forward boom on it. And you had to swing your boom out underneath some high voltage wires. And they had the power company come down and shut this little section down so the wires were not live at the time. But it was, you know, quite an operation because you had to swing the boom out underneath these power cables and unload coal. We had seven trips in a row with the Boland up there to stock them up for the winter. And because it was such a pain in the ass getting up and down the river, it was daylight operations only. So we'd get over there and we'd either have to run check speed or we'd anchor out and wait for daylight to go up the river. We'd go up there and then we'd unload. And by the time we were done unloading, there wasn't enough daylight to get back down the river. So we'd sit there overnight, which we liked quite a bit because, you know, I mean, we could go into town, and back then there were lots of strip clubs. Thunder Bay was kind of a den of debauchery, I guess. It was a lot of fun. We had a good time up there. And back then you could still drink on the you weren't supposed to drink on the boat, but there was a lot of drinking going on.
Sure.
And if you came back hammered, you know, nobody cared. They just said go to bed, and you did, and that was the end of it. So, you know.
So you had to back down the river then? There is probably no turning basin up that far, I wouldn't think.
Yes, there isn't. You back down to what's called Suncor now, right there at the, you know, there is a turning basin as you back down and around the corner. You have to back down quite a ways, and, you know, we'd take a tug back out. So that was a pretty good run, running from Superior over to Thunder Bay. That was a lot of fun.
What is that, about a 19-hour run or 14?
Yeah, it's probably closer to 14. You'd think I would know off the top of my head, but it's not that common of a transit.
And it all depends on the vessel and the power, too, right?
The boat was fast when she wanted to be, but most of the time they didn't want to spend the money. The, you know, steamers, of course, you can, however many burners you want to put on, would regulate how fast you could go. But she was an old boat, and she had just come out of long-term layup. They had just brought her out in 92.
I remember she sat in West Duluth and in Fraser Shipyard for quite a few years.
Right. So she was still, we were still working the bugs out a lot when I was there. And we moved a lot of salt on that boat. So at that time, Morton Salt was the charterer, and the agreement that they had with American Steamship was that they would pay the overtime for any salt repair. So any chipping and painting and rust repair type stuff that you had to do on the board was being paid for by Morton. And so American Steamship's like, have at it. So Morton was paying for the paint, for the primers, zinc phosphate, all that stuff, chipping guns and all the overtime, because salt's really hard on the ship, obviously. But I never did much of that because as a deckhand, I had 100 hours overtime a month without doing any salt repair.
Holy shit.
But the ABs, they loved it. So I was on the Voland in 93. I was the 8 to 12 deckhand. Back then, we still carried three deckhands and three deck engine gatemen, DEGs. And it was a hell of a crew on there. We had some damn good guys. And I probably could tell you everybody that was on there. But
what was your first impression of the ship?
It was huge. It was big. You know, and of course, now I, you know, because she was 639.
Right.
I believe. And now I look at a 600-footer, and oh, that's like a sports car. But coming from a tugboat, I'm like, wow, look at this thing. And I was, again, I still had that kind of mentality from the 60s Great Lakes Fleet stuff. Like, you don't talk to the captain, and you don't. And so one of my jobs was I had to go around and take a sounding every watch. And then I had to go up to the pilot house, and there was a chalkboard up there, and you'd write down your sounding on the chalkboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to the pilot house, and I wrote down my sounding. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't, nothing. I was like a mouse. I came in, wrote down my thing, and I was gone. Half the time, I didn't even know I showed up. I was quiet. And so, as you know, the Bowen is a hand steer. It's a hand jammer. You got to steer it all the time. There's no iron mic. So Klaus Brent was the wheelsman on my watch, and you probably know Klaus if he was there when you were there.
He was, yeah.
And, you know, big guy, big muscular guy. And Klaus was on my watch, and he's always telling me, Charlie, you should come up, you know, learn to wheel. And I, at the time, I didn't realize that he just wanted me to kind of come up and, you know, so he could take a little bit of a break, you know. I thought they were messing with me. I'm like, yeah, I just got here. I'm going to walk right up to the fucking pilot house and go up to the old man and say, hey, you know, you don't know me, but how about I drive your great big fucking boat? And I was like, no, I'm not coming up there. I'm not fucking stupid. No fucking way. So So I never got to wheel the fucking Boland.
Oh, you never did?
I never did it, and I always wished that I had. But no, I never did. So in 97, I'm jumping ahead quite a bit, but this is just a little side note. I ended up on the Indiana Harbor, and that was right after Pete Grunwall had retired, right, and Van Dagen had taken the Indy. And I ended up over there as a wheelsman, and I met Van Dagen again, and I told him that I had worked with him, and he had no recollection of me being on the Boland at all. That's how quiet and, you know, under the radar I was.
Hard to stay under the radar on the Boland. It's
exactly. All the mates and all the other deck crew knew me, of course, but, you know, I was terrified of the old man. I wasn't going to go anywhere near him.
So, are you still in OS while you're on the Boland?
Yep, I just sailed that one fall from October to layup.
That was quite a bit of work on that ship, wasn't it? Changing the winches over for the boom and pulling the hatch covers. Can you kind of remember how all that kind of went?
Oh, yeah. So Ron Bocek was my watchman. He's still sailing, but I think he's just getting ready to retire. He might have hung it up at the end of the season. But Ron Bocek was my watchman. And the watchman, there was a winch at midship. And the winch opened and closed the hatches. It was a hatch winch. So telescoping hatches, you know, they kind of half stack on each other, right?
Right.
So you'd have these paddles, and you would take a block, and you'd run it out to the railing. And each of the railing stanchions had an eye on it, like a steel welded eyelet. And you'd hook the block on there, and you'd drag the other block and the paddles past the length of the deck, because the winch was at midship. So you'd go all the way forward or all the way aft. So we'll just say aft. So you'd go all the way back to the very last hatch, and you'd walk past it as far as you could to stretch the cable out. You'd hang the block on the stanchion that was lined up with that hatch, and you'd walk on top of the hatch, and you'd bring the paddles in, and there were two little pins that you'd lock these paddles into, and then you had a flashlight with a wand on it, and you'd give the watchman the signal, and then he would answer the signal, and then he'd operate the winch, and the winch would pull the cable in, and since the cables run out to the stanchion at the ship side, it would pull those leaves of that hatch open one by one, and they would stack all at the outboard edge of the hatch opening. And so you had two deckhands, one on each side of the ship, doing the same hatches at the same time. We had a guy that was going to the academy, but was taking a winter job, you know, to make some money in between, you know, semesters. And he couldn't carry the block and pull the cable a full length by himself. So I had to go over and help him. I'd have to do my side and then go and drag the cable for him.
What is the block?
A sheave, a pulley.
Oh, okay.
If you were drawing it out at midship, in between the hatches at midship, there would be 2 inches. The cable would go from the winch out to the ship side, to the stanchion. There would be a pulley there, and then it would run parallel to the ship side all the way back aft to the last hatch, and then there would be another pulley, and it would make a 90-degree turn and go inboard to the center of the ship, to the leaf that's at the center of the hatch. And then as it pulled it, it would stack them like cards out at the end, at the outboard edge of the hatch combing.
Okay.
And then to close the hatches, you did the same thing, but now you had to cross all the way over. So you'd go, you're still doing that last hatch. You'd take the block, and now you had to pull from that last block, you'd have to pull it all the way across the ship over to the other side of the ship so that you could grab onto that, what would be the top hatch, which would be the innermost hatch when it's closed, and then it would pull it, and they would all fan out and go back, you know, and close the hatch. But you did the ends first, so that way, when you went to the next hatch, the cable was already strung out. You didn't have to pull it for the next hatch every time. You just pull it once, and you keep your momentum and pull it, you know, half the length of the deck, and then work back towards the center. And then you do the forward end and work back towards the center again. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the wintertime, this is not a particularly fun job to do then.
No, it sucked. And then in the wintertime, after September, you had to put tarps on. So because each leaf of the hatch wasn't sealed to the next leaf, there was an air gap there. In heavy weather, you could take on water into the cargo holds, which many people believe contributed to the sinking of the Fitz if she lost her hatch covers and took on water. So after September 15th, when the weather turns to shit, you have to take big canvas tarps, and after the hatches are closed, you unroll these great big tarps and cover the hatch, and then you had wooden battens, which were like 8 foot long, 2 inch by 2 inch pine boards, you know, 2 by 2, say 8, 10 feet long, whatever they are. And you'd roll the edge of the tarp up into these wooden battens, and then there's these clamps that would pinch the batten against the hatch combing and effectively seal the hatch.
No fun if they got sprayed on and get frozen?
Oh, that sucks. Yeah, absolutely. That was a very big part of our day. And then, of course, if the weather's really bad, they had the option of putting these great big steel beams across there called strongbacks, but we didn't use the strongbacks, and they were all stored up on this stack deck back there. And every once in a while when we had night watch out on the lake where we didn't have much to do, there were a couple of guys that would go back there and they'd grab a couple and throw them over the side. Just in case we ever got a mate that thought maybe we should get those things out, we could say, well, we don't have any, or we don't have enough. So they were on the ship until 93, but in 93 I think they all went away.
Oh, that's funny.
I may or may not have been party to that foolishness.
You know nothing, right?
That's it. So, it certainly was not my idea, let's put it that way. I was new and just kind of, you know, like I say, trying to stay under the radar, but if this is what needs to be done, well, this is what needs to be done.
Now, the Boland wasn't really a big Lake Superior ship in those days, was it? Because of its age, they kept it off the lake a lot up there, or?
Right. Towards December and whatnot, they got it off Superior, but in October, November, we went up there. And, of course, now I realize that half the time the weather is worse in October than it is in November. You know, they just don't write songs about it.
So you sailed the Boland from October up to layup then?
Yep. We laid up in Toledo, Christmas Day. Our cook was Bob Start.
Oh, God, yeah.
I don't know if you know
him. Oh, yeah, I knew Bob real well, yeah.
We laid up in Toledo, and we had lobster dinner, and it was a big deal, and filet mignon and all the stuff. But the reason that I remember it is Bob made a point to make a whole bunch of extra lobster tails and whatnot for the crew. And the deck crew, we all went out there, and we were putting out lines and doing all the shit that we needed to do. And we went in, and we thought, well, there's going to be all this extra leftover lobster and all this stuff. But the assistant conveyorman had taken them all and brought them home to his family. And we were pissed.
Wow. How could he do that?
It was nighttime. Nobody was watching it. The night before was Christmas dinner. Now we're at the layup dock, so now we're, you know, we anchored out to clean up the boat, and we had Christmas dinner. You know, we had it kind of early in the afternoon, and then we spent all night cleaning the boat and getting it ready for layup, and then we showed up at the layup dock at like 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and we pulled into the dock, and we were putting out all the lines and all the dead wires and all the foolishness, and come around lunchtime, we thought, yeah, you know, let's go up and get some of those lobster tails. That'll be great. And we went up there, and they were all gone. And then, you know, of course, that started an investigation, and where the hell did they go? And by the time it was all figured out, the assistant conveyorman, in the middle of the night, had taken them all and brought them home.
And did he come back to the ship?
Yeah.
What was his reception?
Oh, nobody liked him anyway, so it wasn't much different anyhow. But he was a big, big boy, though. He was probably 6'3", 6'4", and 300 pounds. You know, he was a big guy. Kind of an asshole, though.
This concludes this Inland Mariner's audio interview. Thank you for listening. This audio program has been presented by the Inland Mariners, Cypress Pictures, LLC, and Patrick Lipinski. To hear more, go to inlandmariners.com.